You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So last week, I ended up making a wager with my father's partner, who's like my friend, and I said that I would go to church if she would watch this documentary called Earthlings. And Earthlings, in case you haven't seen it, you probably haven't seen it, it's like pretty niche, but it's by this filmmaker called Sean Monson, who basically like tracks the suffering endured by animals like worldwide. He goes into like factory farms and research labs and puppy mills, and he basically like looks unflinchingly at some of the most like terrible practices against animals. And it's narrated by my favorite actor of all time. Actually, no, that's Viola Davis. Like top 10 favorite actor, Joaquin Phoenix. And in case you don't know who Joaquin Phoenix is, he's the main actor in The Joker, and he was also in Walk the Line like a few years back. I would say that was probably the film that launched his career. And then more recently, he's been in Napoleon, which I saw in cinema. And apparently, like commercially, it wasn't like a very good success. But I personally enjoyed the film. Anyway, it's narrated by him, and I have to say I've got a special place in my heart for Joaquin Phoenix, not just because he narrated like this documentary Earthlings, but also I remember when he won the Joker that he like didn't like give a speech talking about how thankful he is to his fans and how grateful he was for the award. I believe he used the occasion to speak about Black Lives Matter at the time, which I thought was very cool. So anyway, going back to the wager, I told my dad's partner that if she would watch Earthlings, then I would go to church. And I haven't been to church in ages because one, I'm not religious. And two, I only tend to go when my mother like needs a partner because she's kind of, I would say she probably has social anxiety, actually. So she does like to go to church, but she doesn't want to go alone because growing up, we always went with her. And so now that everybody's older and they have their own lives, and also my siblings aren't particularly religious, they're not atheists, but they're not particularly religious, they don't go with her. So the last time I went, I think was probably like maybe Christmas. Yeah, maybe Christmas time. So I said I would go to church, and it was my first time going to church alone because I wasn't with my mother, I wasn't with my family member or friend. And actually thinking back, there was a period when I went to church like 14 years ago on a regular basis, and that's because I lived with my friend who was like a pastor. No, I lived with my friend whose dad was a pastor, and we basically, of course, like had to go every week, and you know, it was a very long service. It was like 2-3 hours long. Because they were Pentecostal, and but the great thing was at the end of each like very long service, we would get like really delicious food, and this is when I ate meat back then. So they would have like the most delicious like spread. They would have jollof rice. They would have like puff puff. They would just have really, really good food. So anyway, I said to my father's partner that I would go to church on Wednesday, and last Wednesday, in case you don't follow the Catholic Church calendar, was Ash Wednesday. And so I ended up actually beating my promise to her because I said I would go once. So I had originally planned to go first thing in the morning, which I did. I went first thing in the morning at like to like an 8 a.m. service. And then afterwards, I went later that evening to a 7:30 p.m. service, but this was at a different church. So I wanted to experience two different churches, one a Catholic church and then the other a Church of England. So when I went to the Catholic church, the priest gave a sermon on using Easter and the period around Easter to essentially reinvent yourself, to that it's not just about like giving up chocolate or alcohol or whatever else for Lent, but it's about giving up the things that hold you back from being the person who you want to be, and that the great opportunity in Easter and the Lent period is basically that you can be like a phoenix rising from the ashes of like the bad things or negative things or things that held you back. So I really enjoyed the sermon. And then the second service that I went to was the Church of England one. And that one, there wasn't a lot of like speaking from the priest. It was more like a reflection session. So like there was loads of candlelight. There was very little speaking. They led us to like three different like themed areas, if you will. So the first one was inviting you to reflect on the ways in which you show love in a negative or self-serving way. The other one was about the materialistic things around the world, like in the world that hold you back or hold us back. And then the final one was like talking about how the world is that your oyster. You just have to do the right thing, basically follow the word of God or the word of Jesus. And then afterwards we all came together, and the woman who spoke, she wasn't the vicar, but she was like a clearly associated with the church, like on a regular basis. And she like spoke briefly about what Easter and Lent is supposed to be for. And then afterwards we like, you know, had a few minutes where we were together and just chatting and stuff. And actually throughout the whole service or reflection session, they had like these booklets and they gave you like a pen so you could like note down your thoughts. So I had like loads of thoughts that I was writing down, mostly centered around how I want to be more like selfless when I'm giving love. You know, sometimes like you can use love as a like bargaining mechanism. Like if I show you affection, love in this way, then I hope to get that back. So most of my thoughts were around that. So anyway, long story short, I enjoyed both services for different reasons. But what I really want to talk about in this episode is the like one unifying thing between the two church experiences. And honestly, this is a thing that I have found no matter what church I go to, it's always going to be the central issue. Well, I mean, beyond the fact that I don't think any of it is real, but even if I did, the central issue I will always have is around this. And it's basically the key message that is woven or interwoven in literally every aspect of like your time in Mass and in the things that they read from the text. And that is this idea that you're innately a sinner, that you're born in sin, that you die a sinner, that you were a sinner even before your conception, even before you existed, you were a sinner. And that, you know, the fate of the human population as a whole is that of sin, and therefore are eternally damned unless they accept like God or that or whatever deity you believe in. And then only through focusing your thoughts on gratitude to God for allowing you to draw breath and for allowing you to exist, only when you do that, then you can be saved. So like you being like this wretched, like undeserving, evil, flawed, wicked, wrong, unacceptable person, you can like be allowed to be in God's grace and receive the light of God and love of God if you are grateful and worship enough. So anyway, I will never ever be okay with that message. That is an inherently disgusting message to me. And throughout my experiences, one as a child and an adult and more recently, obviously, when I went to church on Wednesday, like it always creates a schism in me because I'm being drawn into the sermon. So for example, when I went to the first church and he was giving that really empowering sermon about being a phoenix rising from the ashes, I really gravitated towards that message. I think I, like many people, are probably drawn to like spirituality in general because of its opportunity to allow us self-development, allow us to like be better than we are, or to ascend, or to achieve our goals, or to practice being better people. So I was drawn to the message, but each time I felt good about myself, I would be reminded through all these like different things that they said about how I'm innately and inherently evil, which I will never accept. And it ultimately made me like come out of like the sermon each time they would say things. And by the way, I didn't count how many times they said this, but they said it a lot. They said it like maybe like 15, 20 times over the course of the 45, 50 minutes that the Mass like lasted in the first one. And so it's not just like a little, it's not like you can ignore it. Like it's part and parcel of the message. And nothing crystallizes this more than when I read something. So in this church that I went to, the first one, they had like huge screens on the left and the right hand side of the church, and they projected some of the readings that the priest was reading from. And I'll read you directly what one of them said. I could have photographed any number of the ones that popped up throughout the sermon, but this one probably encapsulates what I'm going to talk about in this episode the most. And it reads, quote, "My transgressions truly I know them. My sin is always before me. Against you, you alone, I have sinned. What is evil in your sight, I have done. And then the congregation is supposed to respond, have mercy on us, O Lord, for we have sinned. End quote. Now, although I know that I've always been repelled by this sort of narrative and belief and key message in like the church experience or the mass experience, I had to really sit down and deconstruct what it is about it that repels me for this episode. And I think there are a number of reasons why. The first is that it's counterproductive as far as fostering gratitude in people or fostering gratitude in the congregation. Because even on a basic level, when somebody has done something good for you, and they remind you all the time about the great thing they did for you. Like, remember how I helped you? Remember how you were destitute and I gave you a home? Remember how when you had no money, I lent you money? Remember how nobody loved you, but I loved you? Remember how you had a terrible relationship before me, but now I'm showing you love and care and thoughtfulness in this relationship? Like, when people weaponize the good actions or good deeds they've done for you, even on a basic level, your response is not to feel grateful to them or to be like, oh my God, thank you so much. Oh my God, I'm going to worship you now. Oh my God, thank you so much. I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to make it up to you. We're often repelled by this message because it signifies a weaponization of kindness. It feels as though the kind acts that the person has done for us is now tainted by their power hungriness, and also by this desire to make you go on your knees to thank them. So they essentially want you to denigrate yourself in your thankfulness of them, in your gratitude for them, to them, in order for them to feel like you appreciate the good things that they did for you. And ultimately, like, the response is not usually that you feel thankful or grateful to them. It's usually, at the very least, like a generalized feeling of resentment. Now, going back to the church experience, like listening to a priest for 45 minutes talking about how I should be grateful because I was born a sinner, but God has decided to forgive me, that doesn't make me walk away feeling grateful. It makes me walk away feeling, at the very least, like bad about myself. And if I think about it more deeply, or if I'm more honest, it makes me feel repelled by the messenger. So even if I don't necessarily connect it to the word of God, like I don't feel resentful towards the Bible or to God or to the text or to the religion, I'm at the very least not going to feel close to the priest or to the messenger, whoever that messenger may be, whether it's a vicar or like other religious leaders. So at the very least, it creates a level of distance between the person who's like administering the faith and yourself. And I think that's like relevant and important because ultimately, you're kind of supposed to be very close with your spiritual leader because it's an intimate thing professing your love and belief in a faith and being allowed to be taught by somebody or allowing yourself to be guided by somebody. Like, you have to feel a level of trust and connection and closeness to them. And when you feel either judged or repelled or resentful or suspicious or just like fearful, like a lot of people just fear like being seen truly by their religious leaders because they fear that those religious leaders will see the bad in them. If you're feeling all those feelings, then chances are you're not engaging with the teachings as closely as you could, and you're not internalizing them the way that they're intended because a part of you is going to have your guard up against this person who is the messenger. And you can actually tell very easily that a lot of people have this guard up or have this fear of their religious leaders because they don't go to them for help. Like, when teenagers, for example, experience teenage pregnancies, I guarantee you if they felt close and safe and not judged by their priests, for example, or vicars, they might be more inclined to like seek help from them. Or if children felt as though they genuinely were loved and not judged and didn't see religious figures as these fearful authoritative figures, they might feel more inclined to like seek help from them when they're experiencing domestic abuse at home or other forms of abuse at home or neglect at home or bullying at school. And then as far as adults go, like, a lot of people don't turn to their religious leaders for help when they're going through difficult periods in their lives, when they've lost their jobs or when they are going through separations or when they've experienced like a loss in the family. Like, your spiritual house, if you will, it's supposed to be the people that you turn to. Like, you're supposed to turn to your religious leader for that help, for that spiritual help, for that financial help, for that like community support when you're going through these things. And I think when you're constantly or leading with the message of being a sinner and being bad and being inherently terrible, that is not a welcoming message. That's not a message that people feel embraced by. And then also as far as like the messenger themselves, they are ultimately rendered unapproachable and alienated from the congregation and the community that they're supposed to serve, because you're not going to feel close by somebody who says these things to you, especially says it on a regular basis. And on top of that, like the way in which, like, even the way in which you are seated, they are facing you, they are usually standing like on a raised platform, there's already like physical separation and already like this idea that you are lower than they are. Never mind when they start saying these things to you about how you're inherently evil and inherently bad and how you have to work your hardest for the rest of your life to make up for past and future sins and the sins of all mankind. It's alienating to the congregation, and it's unlikely to make people in their times of need gravitate towards this messenger, this vicar or priest or whoever that religious leader may be. I also think that one of the natural outcomes or inevitable outcomes of attending mass in general on a regular basis is I really think that your self-worth is going to take a hit, not just based on what I just spoke about the language, but even from a perspective of like a lack of representation from the women's perspective. So one of the things I couldn't help but notice in the church, in the first church that I went to, which was a Roman Catholic church, I couldn't help but notice how absent women were in literally everything, not only because none of the altar servers were girls or women. The priest obviously was a man. The speakers were primarily male, although there was one female speaker. And then also just visually speaking, like most of the people like on the walls, most of the paintings were of men. And also throughout the text, obviously when you're reading it or it's being read to you, most of the pronouns are he pronouns. It's he, him, what he did. And there's very little mention of women in general. And when they are mentioned, I feel like they tend to be cast in like the Madonna whore complex. Either it's like Madonna, who's like Mary, for example, talking about women who are self-sacrificing and like inherently good and do the bidding of like goodness, shall we say, or they're like the whore complex where they're the embodiment of like sexual impropriety, essentially. And there's no like just generalized, casualized mention of women who are just living their lives. And I think like that has an impact on how you feel like you can have an active role in the church or have an active role in your religious experience or in the community when they're doing like good works. I do feel like just the usual systemic issues that come from a lack of representation of women in positions of power also manifest in the church's lack of representation of women in positions of power, and also just in like visibly, like how invisible they're rendered in the Catholic Church. I think that's going to have an impact on people's sense of power and empowerment. And also sometimes we forget that there are power dynamics governing the relationship between nuns and priests. This week I happened to watch this film called Doubt, which features Meryl Streep and has like a section where Viola Davis makes an appearance. And as you might guess, I watched it for Viola Davis. And one of the things that I noticed or hadn't really thought about was just the power dynamics between priests and nuns, how they're supposed to be serving. Nuns are supposed to serve priests. They're supposed to basically be hardworking mules, and priests are supposed to be like the almost like they're symbolic husbands, where they're supposed to defer to them, serve them, like be their helpers while simultaneously being invisible and not making any requests for their own needs to be met or not trying to have any positions of power. And maybe like on a conscious level, women aren't sitting there thinking like, oh, I feel disempowered by the fact that there's no representation of women, by the fact that there's no participation of women outside the Madonna whore complex that is denoted in the text or that is preached about. Maybe they don't think that on a conscious level, but I certainly do think that it affects them in other ways. Like, there's no way that you're going to go on a regular basis to mass on Sundays or whatever day you go. And every person who has power in that space is a man, because the priest, the vicar, the monsignor, and then when you go higher up into the bishops and when you go all the way to the very top to the Pope, all of them are men, all of them are male. And so if that is the case, of course that's going to have an effect on how you view yourself in the religious world. At the very least, it's going to have an impact on the things you think are natural for women, how you feel about what natural leadership should look like, i.e. male. It's going to also mean you feel probably less likely to be vocal about things you don't like in the church. Like, you feel less empowered to speak because you see that women are sort of supposed to be invisible. They're kind of supposed to be like these little helpers that don't say anything. And that is reward, that's seen as virtuous. And so for me, like, there's no way that that doesn't have an effect on not only how women feel about themselves and their power and their agency and their role in the church and religious life and also in wider society, but it also affects how men see what the natural order of things should be. It's kind of connected to the episode I had when I was talking about the psychological effects of white Jesus on black people. There's a whole host of things that come from either the exclusion of people who look like you or the representation of them in very limited and sometimes very negative ways. And those impacts are largely negative. They essentially entrench already existing power dynamics that disadvantage, in this case, black people, but also what I've been speaking about here, women. It entrenches the power dynamics that already exist and sometimes amplifies them and give them justification, because they can kind of say that's the natural order in the religious world. And if the religious world is the spiritual guide to the way we should live our lives, then it's kind of saying by de facto, that's the way society should be organized as well. So I personally think it's going to have an effect on the self-worth of women, on the sense of power of women. And then also, I think it contributes, therefore, to the misogyny of men, the inherent belief that misogynistic men have, that they are superior beings to women. The other thing that I thought about as far as the message of, like, you're an inherent sinner has, is like its effect on your level of compassion. And I think when you inherently are told these things, told that you're a sinner and you were born a sinner and all the rest of it, I think you're going to inherently feel like you deserve, like, the bad things that happen to you because, again, like, you're a sinner. And a lot of people, a lot of religious people in particular, you will notice, and I feel like this is so sad, you will notice, like, the most terrible things will happen to them, and it's nothing that they have done, it's not a consequences of their actions, it's just the way the cookie crumbles. Like, bad things happen to good people all the time, as I spoke about in my episode of karma. What people will often say in these circumstances, like, let's say they're diagnosed with cancer, or they lose a child, or they go through financial duress, they will say things like, you know, what is God trying to teach me? Or God doesn't give me a load that I can't carry. Or sometimes they believe that it's punishment for the things that they have done wrong. So it's kind of like, if you accept the premise that you as a human being, as a living being, are inherently evil, then it must mean that when bad things happen to you, you believe that you deserve them. Like, you don't believe that you deserve to live a life that's consequence-free, and you're essentially, like, paying the cosmic price that comes from your inherent, like, sinful nature, if you will. So I do think, like, your compassion for yourself is at the very least, like, limited, because instead of you extending grace and compassion to yourself and saying things like, It's terrible this thing happened to me. I'm allowed to feel sad. I didn't deserve it. You're inclined to feel that you deserve it. And by extension, I also think that some of the lack of compassion that people direct towards others is a direct consequence of not having compassion for yourself. So if you are told all the time that you're a sinner and you're bad and you're inherently evil, it also means that you believe that the bad things that happen to you are deserved. And then it also, by extension, means you believe that the bad things that happen to other people are deserved. Because if you deserve the bad things that happen to you because you're a sinner, then presumably other people, when bad things happen to them, it's because they are sinners too. So anyway, I feel like it has this negative downward circle or cycle on your capacity to feel compassion for yourself and then your capacity to feel compassion for others. That's why sometimes I feel like people have like this casualized like display of cruelty, honestly. Like, very good people will sometimes say like the most evilest of things. Like, they might see a homeless person and they will say like, that person probably deserves it. They won't say it necessarily in those terms, but they'll phrase it in such a way where the implication is that they deserve it. Like, they're on the street because they're drug addicts. That implies that the reason why they are homeless is because they're addicted to alcohol or drugs. But the fact of the matter is that literally like 9 times out of 10, the drugs are helping them cope with the terrible things that have happened to them, usually in their childhood. So it's a coping mechanism. It isn't the cause. And also there's all kinds of systemic reasons why they are on the streets. Presumably the state, the fact that we pay our taxes, so that we can have some kind of socialist values where we look after the elderly, for example, or the sick or the poor. If they're on the street, it implies that the system has failed in some way. So either way, however you slice and dice it, if you don't have compassion for yourself because you believe you're inherently bad and evil and you therefore deserve the bad things that happen to you, you're going to be limited in your capacity to feel compassion and to be compassionate to other people who are going through like miserable experiences like the ones I just described. And actually, before I move on, one other thing that I just remembered is, like, I was once speaking to like a family member who was talking about like how we survived the genocide in Rwanda. And they basically said something like, God saved us because we're good. And I didn't say anything in the moment because they were recounting like obviously traumatic experiences they'd been through. And that was like their way of coping with it. But I couldn't help but feel sad and a little bit sickened by the implication of what they were saying. The idea that God saved us because we were good implies that like hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives because they were bad, or because God thought they were bad and therefore God didn't save them because they're bad. Like, these beliefs have inherently negative implication or logical conclusions when you follow the thought process through. So that was like an extreme like exemplification of what it means when you believe that God like administers your life and what happens to you according to how good or bad you are. It ends up with you casually expressing cruel things and not realizing that the things that you're expressing are cruel. And it's coming from, again, that lack of compassion for yourself and the lack of compassion, therefore, for others. Outside compassion, I also think this belief in an innate sin and an inherent sin has a knock-on effect in our capacity to love, because it's very difficult on a human level to accept bad people who do bad things to us, you know? So like, even in the context of friendship, if you believe that your friend is a bad person, you're going to feel differently about them. You're not going to feel as warm and fuzzy towards them. You're not going to be trusting of them. You're not necessarily going to invite them into the inner sanctum of your life, because that involves you making yourself vulnerable and having intimacy with, in terms of closeness, with somebody who you believe is fundamentally a bad person or has an impure soul. Putting that in the religious context doesn't go away. So if we're being taught that other people and us are bad people and that we've got impure souls and that we're therefore likely to exhibit all these bad things. We're likely to behave in ways that are unpious or unrighteous or wrong or sinful or immoral. If that's like the foundational belief in the nature of people, it's automatically putting a cap in our ability to love other people, because that distrust and that disdain and that sort of suspicion of other people is going to flow through the way that we show love to other people, and also in the way that we show love to ourselves, even outside of the people. Like psychology 101 on self-worth rests on the notion that you believe fundamentally that you are a good person with a capacity to do good, and that you aren't defined by some of the bad things or bad decisions that you have made. Like a belief in those three core things allows you to accept yourself, to love yourself, to be compassionate to yourself, to be kind to yourself, and by extension, to show that kindness and compassion and love to other people. So I fundamentally think if you are looking at other people and looking at yourself as being inherently at a base level bad people, you're not going to be able to love them in a fully compassionate way. This also, by the way, trickles down into the way in which people parent their children. Because if parents are sitting in mass every week and they are being told that they're innocent little babies, the babies that literally have had no life experience, have done nothing, they've only been around for like a few weeks or a few months. If they're told even these angelic little babies who are completely devoid of having done anything wrong, because they literally don't have the capacity to because they're babies, if even they are evil or bad or wrong or wretched or cursed with a fate of being bad people, or cursed with the fact that not only are they bad now, but they'll also grow up to be bad or sinful people. Imagine what level of treatment these parents are inclined to take. You're not going to take necessarily as like the default position a gentle parenting perspective. You're probably going to look at your child's behavior, like the natural behavior that your children exhibit. For example, children are naturally rambunctious. Children are naturally like testing of boundaries. They test boundaries, they question authority, they disobey, they experiment with things. They're curious about things that leads them to experimenting with things. They're also impacted or influenced by the other children around them. They're highly sensitive to being negatively and positively influenced, but in the negative, it can result in them exhibiting bad behaviors, like skipping school, for example, or starting to experiment with alcohol, or starting to experiment with sex. If you fundamentally believe that your children are inherently evil and bad, and their natural nature is to be bad and wretched and immoral and not good people, then you're probably going to be overly harsh with them. You're more likely, I would imagine, to beat them or to be harsh with them or to be less gentle and kind and understanding with them, because they're teaching you to see the sin in a child that isn't there, essentially. And they're also teaching you to like read the natural behaviors that people have, that children have, as being somehow like a confirmation of their sinful nature. So I do think it has a trickle-down effect on not only how you interact with the adults in your life, because you're going to be less trusting, in my view, and more and believe in the fundamental idea that people are bad at their core, but also it's gonna show up in how you love, and part of how you love is obviously how you parent your children. And speaking of children and the messaging that they receive in church, I genuinely feel like this can be tantamount to exposing them to like some form of abuse in a way. Like when you think about it, like if I was a parent or a parental figure or a guardian of a child, and every other week, even if I just did it once a week for an hour, I said things like, "You're worthless. You're lucky I love you. There's nothing you can ever do to be deserving of my love. But despite that fact, I still show you grace. I still allow you to live." Or if I said, "The moment that I looked at you, I knew you were evil. You were born evil. And because you were born evil, you're lucky that I even let you live and that I let you be in my company. Like, we would all correctly identify that as being emotional abuse of children. And ultimately, that doesn't change just because that abuse is happening around other people and, you know, in a holy quote-unquote setting. Like, they still internalize those messaging as far as I'm concerned. That's why a lot of people will carry with them this inherent sense of guilt and shame, and why their intrusive thoughts in moments of low self-worth will be things like, I'm worthless, or I can't do anything right, or see, I am bad, or I'm not a good person. They'll have like these little like intrusive thoughts that go into, that just come out at random moments, or moments when you're feeling low about yourself. And you think to yourself, where did that come from? Because most of the time, I hope, like, your parents didn't say those things to you. It's not like your friends were like whispering these things into your ear every night. I think some of that is definitely coming from being in that religious setting, like being in that mass and having like this priest say these things to you. And then on top of that, not only does he say those things to you, you're asked to repeat that. So they say, you're a sinner, aren't you? And then you have to say, yes, I am a sinner. And please forgive me because I am a sinner. So you're forced to not only hear them say those things, you're also forced to say those things as affirmations, essentially, of your unworthiness. You can't tell me that's not abusive language. It's abusive language to children, and it's also abusive language to like the adults in the room too. And even outside it being like abusive language, I ultimately think the message is designed to make you feel small. I mean, like, sometimes being like feeling small can be a positive thing, or can make you feel empowered. Because if you, for example, go to the beach and you look upon how vast the ocean is, how big the ocean is, and how little you are in comparison. Or sometimes if you're like looking at a night sky and you see how great the sky is, how huge the sky is, and how little you are in the context of the sky and the universe, it can make your problems feel very small, because you're connecting yourself to the grander scheme of nature and life, and realizing the fact that you hate your boss isn't the end of the world, or realizing that even if you're going through a bad patch in your relationship, it isn't the end of the world. Like, they're relatively small issues. So sometimes being made to feel small can have an empowering effect, in that it grounds you in the larger context of life. That's not really what's happening in church, or that's not what I felt when I went to mass. I felt the way that I was made to feel small was designed to make me feel like insignificant, and not just like the bad that I was been speaking about a lot in this episode, like not just bad and evil and sinful and all that stuff, but also like small and insignificant and like sort of humbled. I should be humbled. I should be on my knees. I should be showing gratitude. I should be thankful that the All High, the Almighty, has bequeathed me with breath and life, and I should work for the rest of my life in trying to outrun that innate inherent sin and running towards like gratitude and thankfulness for my existence. That doesn't make you feel big. It doesn't make you feel powerful. It doesn't make you feel positive about yourself and about other people. It doesn't, in a word, make you feel like empowered. And the reason why you need to feel empowered and need to feel big is because those ingredients are needed for you to make those positive changes. So if ultimately you want to be that phoenix rising from the ashes, that image alone is one of power, is like of like this great, magnificent being that's able to transcend its old self, that's able to go through periods of rebirth. That's an empowering message. But if it's rooted in like 15, 20 chantings of your sin, you're sinful, you're not good, you're bad, you're inherently evil, other people are inherently evil, you're going to be evil until the day that you die, like, that makes you feel small and insignificant. And when we feel small and insignificant, we feel disempowered, and we feel like we don't have as much power to influence our actions or like the actions of other people. So inherently it's self-defeating, in that it you require an inner sense of greatness, of power, of feeling powerful, for you to make even like small changes in your life, whether it's like weight loss, or whether it's conquering like bad habits like smoking or conquering addictions. You need to have that inherent like base level belief that you, one, matter enough to look after yourself and to make those changes to improve your life, but also outside the fact that you matter, that you are capable of those things, and ultimately receiving this messaging of how insignificant and bad and small you are, I just don't think that it allows you or is easily aligned with putting you on a path of taking positive actions to take your, to change your circumstances. The final thing I will say about this language of sin, of us being sinners, of the congregation being sinners, of the human population and race being sinners, is I think inherently what it does also is it gives the messenger and the organization that is like the purveyors of like our faith of or faith-based systems, it gives them like unearned like deference and unearned authority. And the thing is, they don't deserve any deference or authority because they're just like people like you and me. Like sometimes, especially when you look at the older generation, they have like such deference to power in general. And this is like my pet peeve with my mom. Like a police officer could tell her to do anything and she will do it. Or a politician could tell her to do anything and she will do it. Like it drives me crazy. Or a doctor could tell her to do anything. A doctor could be like, sell your house tomorrow and she would like consider it. So sometimes like, with the deference to power in the religious context, we forget that they are literally just human beings like me and you. And it's easy to forget this because the way in which they are, like the context in which we take them in, automatically creates that authority or that authoritativeness that they carry. So like I mentioned earlier, you're in a church in a mass somewhere, and all the congregations are sitting in pews, and the priest or the vicar or the pastor or whoever the religious leader is speaking at the crowd from like a raised platform, and the effect that that has is essentially the leader is looking down at the congregation, and the congregation in turn is looking up to him. They're literally looking up to him as he like speaks to them or teaches them or whatever, is saying all the stuff to them. So even physically, the way that you're interacting gives them like this authority anyway. Secondly, like the clothes that they wear is not by accident. Like they choose those clothes because of the association with power and deference and authority and holiness. So there's no real need for them to like wear the white gowns and to have like the colored cloth that they put on either side of their shoulders. Like it's usually different colors for different seasons. So during like Easter, it tends to be purple, but at different times of the year, it could be green or gold or red, depending on the occasion. So anyway, like the clothes that they wear, you see it much more pronounced in the Pope, for example. Like the way that he's dressed, like automatically feels you like he's a man that is not of this world. You feel like he's somehow like holy, like a representation of holiness, like a representation of ascendancy above humanity in a way, you know, because most people, everyday people don't dress in those clothes. They wear, you know, regular clothes. So the fact that they're even dressed in this garb kind of separates them from us in a way that makes us feel like we should shrink ourselves in their presence. The language we use around them also like encourages that power dynamic between us. Like we call them father, we are deferential to them. You know, in churches where there's confession, you go into a box and you confess your sins to them and they have the power to forgive you. You know, like they can bless you and they can tell you to go and pray X amount of times or to take some kind of actions for you to essentially be punished for the thing that you've done and then you'll be forgiven. So they have the power to like forgive your sins essentially. On top of that, like they're in places that communicate wealth very subtly. Like when I was in the Catholic Church, like the first church, one of the things I couldn't help notice was just how like the surrounding area is like a nice area, but it's not as nice as the church. Like the church was on beautiful grounds, as I said. Inside the church, it had like stone wall pillars, like Roman type pillars. It had marble floors. It had like really a lavish display of wealth, a lavish but subtle display of wealth. So again, all those things are going to make you feel like you should defer to not only like the place, like the church that you're in, but also to the priest or the pastor or the vicar or the religious leader. And that also another reason why you can automatically feel like they have this power over you, or and you should therefore show them deference, is because, you know, if you are a sinner from cradle to grave and salvation is only possible through God, and then they, the priests, the vicars, the pastors, are like God's representatives, then automatically you're kind of speaking to God through them. Like, they've positioned themselves to be between you and ultimately God. Like, that's why they can forgive your sins in confession. Where if they weren't representatives of God, then why would they have the power to forgive you or to like forgive your sins? Surely, like, it's supposed to be God to forgive you on judgment day. So in all these like subtle ways, like, they've put themselves in like these throne positions, in like these like God-like positions, honestly. And it's not helped by the fact that like their ultimate like leader, like the Pope, is a king. Like, he is a king by everything but name. You can tell he's a king because he lives in a palace. He has immense, immense, immense wealth. Like, I was looking at how much like the Vatican is worth, and therefore how much the Holy See is worth. And it's very difficult to put a figure on it because, you know, honestly, they're very opaque about their finances. But the Vatican Bank alone, that's right, the Vatican has a bank. The bank alone, as of 2019, managed more than like $7 billion, billion with a B, billion dollars in assets. And in 2010, The Economist did an investigation where they're trying to work out how much money the church has. And they couldn't ultimately put a figure on it because, as I said, their finances are very opaque. But they did find that in 2010, the American like branch of the Catholic Church alone spent over $170 billion, like $170 billion with a B dollars. So if that's only the American like branch, imagine how much money they actually have when you put together all like the thousands of like churches and church affiliated organizations in the world. Like, they've got clearly a lot of bank. And so like the Pope literally is like a king by all metrics. On top of that, he literally sits on a throne. He has a crown that he wears on special occasions. If you look at the ring, like, people literally bow down and kiss his ring when they greet him. He has foot soldiers, essentially, or knights that protect him everywhere he goes, on the grounds and then also when he's amongst the people. Literally in everything but name, he's a king. And therefore, like, the priests are kind of like, not his foot soldiers, but they're like an extension of him. They're essentially like princes. Again, like, the way in which they are presented visually and the trappings of wealth that surrounds them and the sheer political power they have and the sheer social power they have in our communities means that we are more likely than not going to feel deference or be deferential to them. And they're going to like have this unspoken sort of like authority. And the reason why that's bad, I mean, one, I hate to bring this up, but I have to. There's been like hundreds of cases of abuse, of situations and scandals where priests have abused children, have abused women, have abused them for long periods of time, have gone to great lengths to hide it. This is a great film called Spotlight. You want to check that out. But there's, honestly, even type it into YouTube, like, you can find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different cases of where priests and religious leaders in the Catholic Church have abused their power and abused like children and women. And part of the reason why they're able to get away with this abuse and this abuse of power and this predatoriness is because we give them unearned authority, unearned deference. We start to see them as not like flawed human beings like everybody else with a capacity for good and bad. We see them as like God's representatives on earth. We see them as like God's foot soldiers. In many cases, for many people, I genuinely even feel like they see them as like an embodiment of God himself, Otherwise, like, they wouldn't be so deferential. Like, they wouldn't go into a confession box and, like, tell them, like, their the sins that they've committed and accept the notion that the priest or pastor or whatever has the capacity to erase their sins or to forgive them. Because presumably that's supposed to be in... only God is supposed to be able to do that. But honestly, in all contexts, like, deference to power will always leave the person who's giving away their power and agency in a vulnerable position, because it relies on you putting them on a pedestal in all ways. Like, you believe that they are morally superior. You believe that they are not subject to the temptations of everyday life. You assume that they are only motivated by good. You assume all kinds of things that you should never assume. Like, when I used to volunteer for the police, one of the things that they taught us was that there is no such thing as no risk. There is only, like, high risk and unknown risk. And so when you approach people, especially, like, people with power, and you only assume that there is no risk, you're really putting yourself and your children and the people you're putting in contact with that person, you're putting them in danger, honestly. Like, especially because of what we know now, and also because of what we know about the nature of power, and it has to be said, the nature of men with power, is that low risk is probably not the proper risk to assign. You should assign a wait and see risk, or a trust but verify, like, at the very least, like, that level of trust, like, trust but verify, or better yet, like, don't trust until trust is earned. Especially, like, given the background that I've just given, like, the context of, like, one group of people, the congregation, and most specifically the children and women who are more likely to feel small and insignificant and voiceless and are sort of socialized in that religious life to be seen and not heard. If you combine that setup with the combination of, like, priests having literally all the power and all the deference and being representatives of God on earth, and therefore kind of like the rulers over us in some moral or spiritual way, it's a disaster, or it's a recipe for disaster in terms of safeguarding for children and women. Now, my final takeaways for this week's episode, in terms of, like, my experiences, you know, going to Mass on Wednesday and all the things that I observed and thought about throughout the week about that experience or those experiences, are, firstly, I still do think there's a value in having, like, a church. I think a lot of people need a place to commune, like, a place where they can be together, where they're serving the same purpose, where even just the basic act of being in a non-hostile space or a non-aggressive space or a non-competitive space, because that's kind of like the space that a lot of people on a daily basis exist in. Like, you're at work, you're being stressed, you're expected to produce money for, like, the boss and for the machine. You're commuting with people who are really focused on their own lives, and they're bashing into you, and they don't greet you. There's very few moments for tenderness. There's very few moments for, like, being still with other people, communing with other people, like, being, relating to other people in a positive way that isn't rooted in them doing something for you or you doing something for them. So from the perspective of even just being a place for people to commune and have a positive exchange with each other, I think church is very valuable for that. Even, like, little things like people smile at you, or they're tender with you, or they move over for you, or they invite you to sit next to them. Or my favorite part of Mass is always when the part where they say, like, give peace to one another. You know, the priest says something like, peace be with you, and then let's give each other the sign of peace or something. And I love that part. You, like, shake hands with people. In the Church of England that I went to, the second one Mass that I went to, like, people actually hugged. And even just that physical contact, that positive exchange, is communion. It's a place of communion. It's a place of connection. So I like that part. I think that part is valuable. I also think that people need a place, as I said, to reflect and to be reminded of the things that affect their hearts and minds. Like, on a daily basis, I do think we suffer from living in such a fast-paced life, especially when you live in a big city like London, is that you can really go weeks and months, maybe even years, without having moments of, like, honest self-reflection, moments of looking inward and assessing, like, assessing your character, assessing whether you are living life according to your own values. Like, are you being the kind person that you want to be? Are you being the compassionate person that you want to be? Are you loving others and the people who are in your life to the fullest extent that you can, or in the purest ways that you can? Are you being spiritually and emotionally being fulfilled? Like, we don't have many opportunities for that level of inward reflection and self-reflection. So church is a useful avenue to do that, because some of the teachings are, of course, going to be around the things that you do defining your character. And I honestly enjoyed the Church of England service that I went to, the evening service, that even had those like booklets printed out with spaces for you to write your thoughts and feelings on the various prompts of discussion that they had. It was a very useful exercise, a very needed exercise. The other reason I think church is still valuable is, as far as spiritual teaching is concerned, I think that is very, very valuable. Like, especially for churches that actually do good things, like, they do lots of charity work. They do go around the community and look after the sick and commune with the sick. They do things like cleaning up the community. They volunteer at hospitals or like old homes, like old people's homes. Like, for me, like, that's a physical manifestation, like a putting into practice like spirituality. And if you can be in a space where there are people who are reminding you to do those things and inviting you to participate in those kinds of activities, I ultimately do feel like there's a certain sense of feeling connected to your community and to other people, a certain sense of having a purpose of helping others that makes you feel good about yourself and grounds you in your life. And then also beyond that, it's like a reminder to be a good person, to do good things, to show your goodness through your actions and your deeds, and not just purely just based on your thoughts, like actually doing something that aligns with your values. So I think being in a place on a regular or semi-regular basis that reminds you of that fact, I think is really, really valuable. They're the positive aspects of my takeaways. I also have some, what would they call it in like an HR review? Some areas for improvement, shall we say. And the overarching theme, I would say, is that in my personal view, if the church as an institution is not only going to survive but thrive in the millennia to come, it needs like a massive facelift. The first area where it needs a facelift is in the language. I don't know if it's because I'm particularly sensitive to language and to how language makes me feel and the messages that we communicate through our use of language, but the language needs to change. Like, we're in a world where they're competing for our attention and our time and our presence in their institutions. And ultimately, a lot of people can get like that sense of empowerment and connection from other areas. Like, even if it's just like influencers that you follow that make you feel good about yourself, that tell you you are worth something, that you are a good person, that you can achieve these goals, like, they are competing with a lot of other influences and influencers, whether it's like on the social media front or even just like other organizations. Like, think of mental health organizations or therapy organizations or self-development coaching or self-development work. There's loads of organizations geared towards helping you be the best version of you in whatever form that takes. And so because the church is competing with all those other like groups, shall we say, or organizations, who are using like positive, empowering language that makes you feel significant, language that makes you feel powerful, language that makes you feel like you can accomplish things. Because they're like competing with that kind of language from other organizations, they're going to have to transform the way that they speak to the congregation, like their key messaging that's rooted in like that inherent sin and that inherent like being bad. I just don't think it's going to like encourage people to stay in the church, especially because we're a relatively empowered generation. Like, there was a time when people would like go to church because they had such little understanding of the world and of science that they kind of hedged their bets against bad things happening to them by going to church. So if they believe, for example, if they didn't go to church, their crops would be bad, or they believe that their family members or they might fall sick, or they believe that if they did fall sick, if they went to church then and followed religion, then they would have a chance of like surviving that illness. Because we know a lot of things about like medicine and science, like where weather comes from, how certain diseases developed and are treated. Like, they can't keep us in that congregation, in those congregation seats, merely by promising us that we're going to be in God's favor and those bad things aren't going to happen to us, because we're too knowledgeable now. The way that they can like keep us there is by being like a house of spiritual connection and spiritual development. And in order for them to relay that message in a way that makes people feel inclined to return over and over again, they need to step away from like this negative messaging of like being innately, inherently, and forever sinful or bad or evil. And this next point is maybe a little bit petty, but I also just feel like they need to improve like their public speaking skills. Like, the first priest I went to was a good speaker, an engaging speaker, but I have definitely been to masses, especially in Ireland, in my town, where boy, oh boy, oh boy, it is so dry. Like, even if I was inclined to go because I believe in the teachings, like, you have to be an engaging speaker. Like, you are a public speaker. You are teaching the public about things. And so for you, like, most of the time, it's not just about what is said, it's how it's said. It's the way in which things are phrased. It's the energy with which it's given. It's just the stylistic flair of being able to be a good speaker. And so I do feel like they forget that that's their primary job, or that's their primary way of recruiting congregation members to stay. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that they should take the route of like these performance pastors you see in the US contexts, who are like super, super engaging and really like animated and energetic. But sometimes you do think like it errs on the inappropriateness. I'm not saying go to those extremes, but at the very least, they should be engaged public speakers, and they should take training if required, because sitting there for 45 minutes while you listen to somebody drone on with no variation in tone, no engaging of the public, just speaking at them for 45 minutes it's not productive and it's not conducive. Connected to that, I also think they need to take a more like scholastic approach to teaching. Like, for me, one of the things I enjoy about studying religions as a whole in general is I love when they interpret texts and they put historical context to the text. So they're like, this is why they've said this. This is what these words mean. These are the origins of these words in Latin or Greek, and this is what the original meanings are, and this is why we understand the translation to be this. Or I enjoy when they tell us about cultural practices and historical practices that we don't see now, but that really like helps explain some of the things in the text. I love like that scholastic approach to teaching like religion, or teaching the Bible in this case, or teaching any religious text. And I feel like sometimes like either the priests aren't incentivized to do so, to have a discussion about the text, to have an interpretation of the text, to involve the congregation in their interpretation. They're not encouraged to be engaging, again, in the way they speak. So I would welcome a scholastic approach where they like deconstruct the Bible for us, because a lot of people, I tell you, have not read the Bible, have not read much of the Bible, couldn't tell you, even if they like remember certain passages, I don't know if they necessarily like truly understand it. They have broken down like the sentences and the words and could explain to you exactly what things mean beyond just being able to like repeat them by rote. So honestly, like a better engagement with the text, I feel like would encourage people who are intellectually curious, encourage people who are in like interested in learning about things and developing their understanding of their religious texts. Another takeaway from my experience was that I honestly think it's overly commodified. Like, there's something quite distasteful about looking over at that section where they have like little candles in glass jars where you're supposed to be able to like light and basically have a moment of reflection. Usually people tend to light them for people who have passed away, and it's their way of like reminding and connecting with their loved ones that have passed. There's something distasteful about like charging money to light that candle, which was the case where I went, and it's a case where like in other places I've been to as well for prayers or whatever. Like underneath the candle section, it said something like 50p per candle. Now, putting on my hat of knowing what things cost, a little tea light in a glass jar does not cost 50 pence, because you can go to like Tesco or Asda or the Poundland, whatever shop you go to, and buy like a pack of like 30 or 50 of those candles for like a pound or for like a couple of pound. And so automatically I already know they're making a margin on the candles. And I know it sounds petty, but at the same time I think like, not only should you not charge for spiritual reflection, if you are going to charge, it shouldn't be you're making a profit on that. At least like do it so you're just covering your costs, because you can make other, like, because they make money, obviously, through donations, through people giving money throughout the service, like during like the basket collection. So I kind of feel like there's something a bit tacky about charging somebody money to light a tea candle that costs literally next to nothing to buy. And on top of that, outside the tea candles, like maybe I don't know if you've noticed this if you go to church, but they now not only pass the basket around, but they also say that you can pay by card machine, you could pay by PayPal, you could pay by cash transfer or bank transfer, you could pay through like apps like Revolut. Like, there is just something distasteful about it. There's something overly corporate about it in a house that's supposed to be about non-materialism, a house that's supposed to be about everybody being welcome, that isn't supposed to be so like focused on money. And honestly, like, I did think, how would somebody with no money feel going to church? Because if I'm being charged 50p even just to light a candle to reflect on somebody who's died, and they're basically saying you have no excuse to not give money because you can now pay by credit card, debit card, PayPal, and all these other ways of paying. There's such an emphasis on it that it kind of feels like if you don't have money, then it's like subtly like not a space for you. The other thing I thought, especially in the first church that I went to, because it had like loads and loads of beautiful, beautiful paintings on the walls, like of angels and people in clouds and in the sky, and some of Mary, some of other holy figures or religious figures. One of the things I noticed is just like, the iconography needs to be more diverse. Like the way in which the representation of religious figures and of people in general on those walls needs to be more diverse. This is particularly more like evident or highlighted because the priest himself was African. So you had an African priest like preaching to a congregation in which every single religious like painting and picture and everything, every single one of them was white, was denoted as white. Not like ambiguous white, but like mostly light hair and light eyes. I had an episode when I talked about the psychological effects of white Jesus on black people and people of colors, like experiences of religion and stuff. It reminded me of that, basically. I was like, there's something a little bit perverse about having a diverse congregation that comes from all walks of life and different backgrounds, or like people of African descent there, people of Asian descent there, but all the religious holy figures are all white. Like, you can't tell me that's not going to have a psychological effect in terms of how welcome people feel in that space, how much they feel like that space belongs to them equally. And also in terms of just like how they view how they even conceptualize like God and their closeness to God. Like, if we are the embodiment of God, but God is only ever represented as white, presumably that implies that we are not godlike, or we are not made in God's image. Like, it does have an impact on how people view themselves psychologically, and how it actually trickles down to lots of other things that I spoke about in that episode, so you should check that out. But it has all kinds of knock-on effects and all kinds of impacts on entrenching racist ideas about leadership, about cleanliness, about holiness, about leadership, about who has a right and a claim to heaven, and who is inherently like more good or who's inherently more bad. It has all kinds of implications when you're taking in these visuals on a daily basis, and the representation of goodness and holiness and religious piousness is always people who are not in your likeness, or it's never people who look like you. The second last takeaway I have, I want to talk about, is I just think they need to allow more women to take active like roles in the church, in positions of leadership, speaking to the congregation, being allowed to be to administer masses, being in the positions of bishops and vicars. Actually, they do have female vicars, I'll give them that. But in general, there needs to be more female participation. I would love to see nuns holding more positions of power and not just being like second-class citizens in the church, essentially. And I think that because, one, I personally feel like women are better suited to leadership in general because they're socialized to be more collaborative or collaboration seeking, and they aren't as socialized to be power hungry or to ignore the suffering of others. They are more inclined to not abuse their power, honestly. I also think that they lack the capacity to physically coerce people. So the reason why there are significantly fewer female abusers of like children and women and men is because they also lack the physical capacity to do so. They also don't tend to be like sexual deviants for the most part, because like I dare you to find me like scandals where you have nuns who have like engage in widespread sexual abuse of like children and other women and maybe other men. Like, you're not going to find it because it doesn't tend to be, it just isn't as prevalent in the female group. And apart from what, outside me believing that there would be better representation and fewer instances of abuse of power, I also think it's needed to modernize the church, because for me, at the very least, it's a little bit creepy to see only men being able to participate and administer like masses and to be heads of congregations, because it doesn't reflect the world that we live in. Like, maybe that was okay in like the 1960s or 50s or 40s, when women in general, you know, at least like middle class women, weren't in the workforce, weren't in public life as much. So it kind of wasn't that different to go into church and see that they're not reflected in service and administering church and being positions of power. But in the here and now, in this year, 2025, it is kind of jarring to live in a life in a world where, at least in the West here, there is relative parity and equality amongst the sexes in many, many fields. Obviously, it's not perfect, in many, many fields. And so when you go into church, it feels like a step backward. It feels like, ooh, like this is a weird situation where all the power is imbued to men and women are, like I said earlier, essentially invisible. So I feel like, I don't know how long they can maintain this stance of excluding women from being able to be equal participants, and how much that's not going to cost them. And I think the way it costs them is that people just don't feel, they just feel like it's an institution that's disconnected from modernity and disconnected from like the way that some of the values that we have acquired, namely equality between the sexes. Now, the final thing I will talk about is, in terms of my takeaway, is I think it's going to be very difficult for the church to be as embraced in modern times if they don't disavow or like let go of their homophobia. And the reason why I think they should disavow their homophobia is like twofold. One, it's a disservice to the priests and nuns who serve under their organizations. I personally think that a huge segment of nuns and priests are gay. Like, the reason why they gravitate towards the church, and bear in mind that level of sacrifice and abstinence and suppression of your natural human desires, whether that's the desire for romantic love or the desire for sex and sexual expression, the desire for physical affection, the desire for a family, like, it takes a lot of sacrifice to be able to live a life like that. It's in many ways not a natural life. And so for me, when I think about the kinds of people who might like be drawn to that kind of lifestyle, I think it's people who, one, like see the church as a way of abstaining from their nature because they see their nature as being bad. So that they feel like if they join the church and they do God's work, it'll give them the strength, quote unquote, to like fight their nature, or it'll give them an opportunity to be able to gain God's favor because they aren't acting on their emotions and their feelings and their nature. And on top of that, they're engaging in like a pious life, quote unquote, where they're turning away from all like worldly trappings to serve the interests or to fulfill God's will. So through those two mechanisms, I feel like they are able to suppress their gayness, I suppose you could say. Also, another reason why I think they're gay, a lot of them are gay, is all the scandals, all the sex scandals we hear. So obviously it's not just like gay priests who are engaged in like sex scandals. It's also like straight priests who, as we know, have a track record of abusing women, including nuns, by the way. But outside the straight priests, there's a disproportionate representation of scandals that are of a gay nature, that are of a same-sex nature, which points to the idea that clearly there's some form of like sexual oppression taking place. Otherwise, there wouldn't be like this overrepresentation of those kinds of sex scandals. And some people like often say like it is impossible that the church will turn against their homophobia, that gay and lesbian people will ever be welcome into the church fully. Because I know some churches now do like, there's a few local ones that I've driven by where they have like a flag that says all people are welcome or there's no judgment here or whatever. But in general, people think like religion and specifically the Catholic Church and Catholicism and Christianity is incompatible with like accepting same-sexness as like a nature or a way that people are. But honestly, I feel like that is short-sighted thinking because there are other quote-unquote revolutionary ideas that have been accepted that 50, 60, 70 years ago, actually go back a little bit further than that, but still like within that time period would have been like unimaginable. So for example, like we will not forget that the church was used as to justify racism, to justify the practice of racism and the subjugation of Black people in particular, but also people of color around the world. And when these missionaries would land in Africa or in Latin American countries, like they would use the Bible, specifically quoting, for example, Ham, the curse of Ham, to push the idea or to use as justification the subjugation of people of color in general. So there was a time when the curse of Ham was a legitimate form of explaining why racism was okay. We cannot conceive of that now. We cannot conceive of somebody saying the reason why like X group of people of color should not be allowed to vote or should not be allowed to hold positions of power, should not have legal protection, should not have the right to own property, should not be property, or even going back to the church context, should not be allowed to sit amongst like the other congregations, the white congregations, because like they're Black or brown or whatever. That's inconceivable now, but there was obviously a time when that wasn't the case. I also just feel like that's going to be the nature of homophobia, in that it's very normalized now. But if you notice, like the Pope made some comment where he used the F word, like a derogatory term for gay men. I don't know if it was last year or maybe like a couple of years ago, but he received massive, massive, massive backlash for that. And there is a time when he could say those things and nothing would happen. There would be no backlash. There would not be. There would be no societal backlash. There would be no forcing of the Vatican, for example, to release an apology or to release an explanation, whereas now that's very much the case now. So I just do feel like not only is it in their own interests to not make it hostile for the gay and lesbian priests and nuns amongst them who serve their church and their communities, I also think from like a self-preservation point of view, I don't know how sustainable it is to continue to hold beliefs that are against what society thinks is moral. Like, even Christian people, Catholic people will feel very uneasy at the very least when it comes to discussions of the church's homophobia, because a lot of them are not aligned with the church's position. And so they very much, like, if you have ever spoken to religious people when it comes to this particular point, they are so keen and so quick to try and minimize and reduce and diminish what their church or their religion says about gay people, because they ultimately feel shame about those beliefs. And given that the congregation itself feels that level of shame and doesn't support those views, and those views are also in contention with society's progress, I just feel like from a self-preservation point of view, it's not sustainable to continue to have the stance on same-sex relationships. Now, I had said that was the last point, but actually the last point I wanted to make was, in case you haven't heard it in a while, like, you are fundamentally a good person with a capacity to show kindness and compassion to the people in your life, whether it's your friends or family or strangers or even just like work colleagues, like, you're able to make those choices to be good. And the choices that you make define what your character is. There's no inherent badness or evilness or even goodness in people. We're the sum total of our actions. And I use sum total like very intentionally, because in as far as we're defined by our actions, we're not defined only by our worst actions. Like, if you add up all the things that you've done in your life, it's not as though if you've done one particularly bad thing, then that means you're a bad person. No, that's just a bad thing that you did in the past. And you can make up for that by just being a better person today and making better choices today. So that might look like, maybe there's been infidelity in your life before, now you're going to devote yourself to your partner. Or let's say you haven't been as generous to your friends and family as you honestly feel like you should have been, or you haven't been as present as you feel like you could have been. Like, every day is a new opportunity to make positive changes, and those positive changes are the ones that define who we are and who we can be to other people. I also think that compassion and kindness starts at home. So it starts by being kind and compassionate to yourself, to your children, to your siblings, to your family in general, to your spouse or partner. Like, how you treat them will show up in how they in turn end up treating others. You will notice, for example, that people, when they are being mistreated at home, like children in particular, usually what happens if they don't recoil into themselves and make themselves all small is they tend to end up being bullies and end up being like bad to other children. And that's happening because they're not getting the love and compassion and kindness at home. And so if you want like a better circle around you, shall we say, if you want the people who you associate with to be kinder and more compassionate people, like, one, focus on yourself and being that person to you, and also being that person in your sphere of influence. Like I said, like, treat your children with compassion and kindness that's based on the understanding that they are fundamentally good people who deserve your kindness and compassion, and then apply that as well to yourself and apply that to the people, like, extended people in your life. And I also have to say, I personally think that it extends beyond how you treat other people. Like, in my view, like, the measure of a person, and not just my view, but a lot of people, the measure of a person is how you treat people who can't do anything for you, like how you treat people who are powerless over you. And I'll go back to the documentary that I was, essentially begging my father's partner to watch, Earthlings. One of the things that really taught me was about the bounded nature of compassion that we have for animals, because watching that documentary, I never really thought about the suffering of animals. I never really thought about how they are sentient beings. I never thought about how they have a desire to live and a capacity to feel love, and they have like their own agency, like they want to live. Like even watching my cats every day, watching the decisions they make on a daily basis of like when to nap, when to interact with you, when to show you affection, when to ignore you, like when they want to go outside and explore, like what I've got two cats and sometimes they're like in a mood with each other, how they engage with each other, and how there's like all these like little political things that take place between them, where one day they're beefing, the other day, like another day they're okay. I never really thought about the fact that they have personhood in the sense that they've got their own ways of thinking and they've got their own desires, and those desires may not look like ours, they may not be understandable to us, but they are nevertheless desires, and desires to be safe and loved and cared for and all those things. And I bring this up in the wider context of like how one area affects another area. Like working down the chain, you will often find that men, for example, and I hate to pick on men, I pick on men a lot, but hey, you know, turn on the news and usually they're the purveyors of violence. But one of the things you will see is if men are cruel to women, they will probably also be cruel to children. And if they're cruel to children, they'll also be cruel to animals. So it's like a link going up. And the reverse is also true. People who are cruel to animals, I guarantee you, are also cruel to children. And I guarantee you they're also cruel to women. Because the thing that is defining that cruelty is having power over people who are powerless over you. And feeling like the way that you feel powerful is being able to exert power or violence or cruelty over those powerless groups. So honestly, in terms of like compassion and kindness, not only does it start at home and with yourself, and in particular how you treat people in your immediate circle, it also extends to how you treat people who are powerless over you or beings that are powerless over you. So anyway, before I start preaching vegetarianism, I'm going to wrap up this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you liked the episode and have any just thoughts or comments or things you disagreed with or things you want to share to other people, send me an email. It's always in the show notes, and I will either bring it up in a live episode, not live, I mean pre-recorded episode, or I will send you an email back. Also, if you could like the episode wherever you get your podcast from and leave me a review if you have the time, I'd really appreciate it because it just helps people find the show, the podcast. And so with that, enjoy the rest of your week and I'll see you again next Monday.